Chapter 14.
Continued.
Firing the screenwriters in defense of Angus worked a temporary resurgence in my affections for Blair Gaines. Were it not so common in women my age, I might be embarrassed to have found this authoritarian display such an aphrodisiac. But it is common. Lucky girls learn to let go of their fathers early. I was no luckier than most. In my own defense, I can say at least that Blair's exercise of power, while merciless and even brutal, was all the more attractive to me because it was just and because it was genuine, not for show or to impress me. It had, in fact, everything to do with Angus and the integrity of his story, and nothing whatsoever to do with me. Blair did not know that throwing a lightning bolt in defense of Angus would draw me toward him, nor, frankly, that he even needed to worry about me drifting away in the first place. As far as Blair was concerned, sexually speaking, I was his. Of course, we both knew that he was rapidly losing control over his romantic attraction for me. Romantic, in the fullest sense of that word. Eclipsing everything sexual, and we both, for our own reasons, tried to suppress this fact. As it turned out, my reinvigorated lust made our relationship easier on both of us, temporarily dwarfing, as it did, the swell of Blair's more complicated feelings. We became, for a short time, again, irresponsibly libidinous teenagers, and the world around us simply a place of stolen moments and small enclosures, rooms within rooms, elevators, bathrooms, kitchens, rooms with furniture and footrests and handholds, desks and chairs and countertops, whose sole function was to support our bodies and encourage our need to be devoured. Much of this reckless abandon occurred within the 3 weeks following that lunch. Blair called for an immediate hiatus in the production schedule, and spent several days fighting with producers over the delay and the expense of idle labor. The screenwriters had been Brightleaf Studio darlings from the beginning, and their summary dismissal ruffled more than a few feathers. Several of the producers threatened to pull out unless they were reinstated, and Blair threatened to pull out if they returned. Still so new to the game, I genuinely feared that the entire project would be scrapped. But Blair knew what he was doing and assured me that no one was about to let the movie go. He was right. The challenge was not in convincing the money men to hang in there. The challenge was convincing Angus Mann to take over the script. Blair was prepared to do the rewriting work himself if necessary, but he wanted Angus. It did not matter to Blair that Angus had never written a screenplay. Blair had written screenplays, and he could structure the scenes and pencil in the lighting and the camera angles, and otherwise bridge the gap in Angus's technical knowledge. But it was the heart of the story that was missing. An ineffable quality that the screenwriters would never have known in a million years, and which even Blair was at a loss to identify with any real particularity. "It's a wreck, Tilly John. It's a bloody wreck, and I don't know why." The more he pondered the story Angus had written, the more he hated the screenplay, even wondering at times how he had ever thought it was passable.
"There is something true, Tillyjohn, in that phrase, lost in translation,"
he said to me once as his post-coital mood deepened into a quiet bruise, and he drew languid shapes in the steam on the window above the jacuzzi.
"What we need is an interpreter, a guide, a translator. We need Angus Mann."
Blair's initial efforts at persuading Angus were met with a lot of unreturned phone calls. We surmised, correctly, I think, that Angus had locked himself in his hotel room with a bottle of bourbon. Angus had a reputation as a drinker, and although I had seen a great deal in him that might have been consistent with alcoholism, his reclusion, his cantankerousness, the redness of his cheeks, I had never actually seen him intoxicated. Quite the opposite. Even at his most antisocial, Angus was never uncomprehending, never thick or dulled in his perception. He caught everything. Even his tirades were eloquent and lethal, hardly the inebriated rants one might expect of a habitual drinker. But when I met him on the street in front of his hotel, he was unkempt and disheveled, and his eyes were shot with veins of red, as though he had not slept in the weeks he had gone missing. He was certainly no less formidable in manner or mind. But I suspected alcohol just the same. I was relieved and a little surprised to see him. Blair and his staff had tried the hotel endlessly. Angus had not checked out, but he was never in. I told Blair that I thought he had simply climbed onto a plane and returned to Ohio. It's not like the hotel was his responsibility. It was all on the studio. Why not just go home? But I did not know that for sure, any more than I knew that Jack Daniels or Jim Beam or Johnny Walker had barricaded Angus inside a hotel suite. What I did know was that nobody knew where he was, and that this caused in me an insidious, creeping worry. Once, when I was young, I discovered a puddle of water in the basement utility room of our home. The room was mostly a holding cell for my father's junk, a museum for the remnants of false starts and bad ideas, a shrine to the power of impulse. These things, these abandoned cocoons, filled the knotted pine shelving and stuffed the lime green pressboard cabinets until the first layer of things had begun to serve the functional purpose of supporting a second layer of things. Every National Geographic issue ever published, most of which had never been opened, old darkroom equipment, boxes of a pink vitamin supplement powder, a telescope, and stacks of star mapping books. Two acoustic guitars and colorful paper-bound books of sheet music for songs like "Teach Your Children Well" and "If I Could" and "Classical Gas." Watercolors. Antique box cameras. A home brewing kit. Boxes and boxes of empty photo albums. Greta stood in the corner of that room, armless on her concrete platform, with her faded blue conical head and her large gunmetal eyes and her blinking red heart. I understood nothing of boilers as a child, except that they hissed and thrummed and clicked in small, dusty rooms that were off-limits to children. Rooms that, perhaps for that reason, made for exceptional places to hide. But Greta made more sense to me than a boiler. She was a dusty, pallid white, perched on black iron heels that showed through a lacy skirt of rust along the bottom, as though she had been walking through filth. She was the guardian of my father's things. She was the woman who consented to being locked away in our basement, just so that these things would be safe, and so they would not escape back into the world. It was her unwavering sense of purpose that impressed me. Greta knew who she was. The puddle had formed beneath an elbow of silver piping inside a sink cabinet where I was crouching. I huddled in the dark, breathing in the dank smell of the place for well over 20 minutes, listening to my brother and his friend, Peter Wilson, as they turned the entire house inside out looking for me. Every 20 seconds, through the thumping and calling from upstairs, I heard the thin splat of water from beneath my legs and could feel the spray against my bare calf. Long after they had given up the game for Jell-O squares and reruns of Doctor Who, I sat in the dark, listening to that drip, 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 like a clock, like a heartbeat. That was the afternoon I found the box of magazines next to me all that time under the sink. Not just Playboy, which I had seen before in David's room, but other magazines, thin and glossy and incomprehensible. Greta was displeased and made her sounds. I did not tell David or Peter. I did not tell anyone. The junk room was quietly filling with water, and I told not a soul. That night, I laid awake for hours, the sound of drips in the basement of my brain, slowly filling with worry about what I knew and the injury I had caused my father. It was a strangely similar worry that plagued me in the days that followed the disappearance of Angus Mann. Far beneath my conscious irritation, I sensed that a destructive process, some ruinous liquefaction, was underway that I, somehow, had started and was responsible for stopping. I found daily excuses to pass by Angus's hotel. Even on more than one occasion, eating lunch in the brasserie and loitering along the lobby shop windows, looking, but not really looking, for a birthday present for my mother, hoping for some visual confirmation, some proof of life. But nothing. I stopped that charade when it became clear I was unable to reconnoiter in anonymity. My tabloid publicity and my celebrated turn as Katie Finn in Peppermint Grove had ensured that I was noticed just about anywhere and in any manner of attire. The baseball hat and sweatpants were no disguise. Within 10 minutes, I was signing autographs. A man handed me a flower. Another asked for a date. I marvel that even back then, I hated it. The sycophantic thrumming. I just didn't know it yet. Like so many things, I secretly hated what I needed. Given my lack of success on these not-so-discreet missions, it is all the more ironic that I spotted Angus in front of his hotel when I was simply passing by one day. I was coming from my body training session and was on my way to the studio, no less than a 30-minute drive, even on a good day. I was late and had no intention of stopping to look for Angus. Blair was to be supervising the installation of the newly coated sections of the Rutan Baker Dome. Nothing about that event required my presence, but Blair had insisted, and I had obeyed. My route past the Wilshire Hotel was purely fortuitous, due to an accident that had shut down southbound Buena Vista and forced a detour. As I approached the intersection, I could see paramedics talking slowly at a man in the driver's seat of a mangled silver Saab. He showed no signs of listening or comprehending their words. His hands were still gripping the wheel, and he was quietly bleeding from his ear and the corner of his eye. His nose was a pulpy mess. He was staring out the empty frame of his windshield, the twisted motorcycle lying in the road in front of him, the rider under a stained sheet near the meridian. I was thinking of Mr. Saab's face and of the dark dawning in his bloody eyes when I saw Angus on the sidewalk outside the hotel. He was smoking a cigarette with a maroon and gold bellhop who, given the general incongruity of Hollywood, could just as easily been a lost drumless majorette. I circled the block and parked.
Angus!
I waved and yelled at him from a quarter of a block away, concerned that he would disappear into a throng that was gushing from a caravan of black SUVs into the hotel. He looked up slowly, registering no surprise to see me. He took a drag of his cigarette and looked away. The bellhop was now busy slinging luggage from the back of one of the SUVs onto a cart. I saw that he was far too old to be a majorette.
"Where on earth have you been?"
I tried not to sound recriminating.
"Hollywood," he said after a moment, "which I have concluded is not of this earth."
"We've left messages. Blair has been trying."
"Yes. How is old Blair, anyway?"
He looked at me wryly, and it was then that I realized that he looked like hell. And I suspected that he was just then reemerging from a binge. I ignored the question, pretending not to understand what he meant.
"So, you've been here this whole time? We came by the hotel."
"I haven't been at the hotel."
"Where?
What does it matter?"
"It doesn't. I thought maybe you went back to Ohio."
He contemplated the end of his cigarette.
"What I can't figure out, Matilda, is why I ever left Ohio in the first place. Did you know that Sherwood Anderson never left Ohio? Never once. Not even for a few days. Certainly never to make a movie."
"Clark Gable left Ohio, and he never looked back."
"Touché. Is that why you left? To make movies? To be a star?"
"I don't know. I guess. To figure out who I am."
"Have you?"
What?
Figured it out.
I'm an actor.
Are you now?
Yes. Angus, you really need to talk to Blair, seriously.
I find that strange.
What?
That a person would define herself as an actor.
It's not like I'm the only one, Angus.
Acting is what you do, loosely speaking. It's not really who you are, is it?
I'm an actor, Angus. Jesus, I'm an actor. It's who I am, it's what I do. Okay?
Suit yourself.
Another drag, as he took a passing interest in a man angry with a taxi. The taxi honked its reply and sped away.
But you do all kinds of things, don't you? I should hope that you are not everything that you do. That would be quite sad and a little sordid, wouldn't it?
I caught the unspoken aspersion, and I was angry and ashamed all at once.
Why don't you just make your point?
He shrugged.
No point. I'm just saying that by my way of thinking, we are what we want, not what we do. We do all kinds of things, but it is what we want in life that defines us. Writing is what I do. Waste time in Hollywood is apparently what I do. But that says far less about me than what I want.
Which is?
To be left alone.
His voice was warm and casually conversational, but the sentiment was so genuinely cold, so desolate, it was enough to make me ache.
Well, I want to act.
How badly?
Bad enough to put up with your shit, Angus. Look, I'm parked right around the corner. I'm on my way to the lot to see Blair. He really wants to talk to you.
Do you know the sad commonality between writers and actors?
No, but I bet you're going to tell me.
We are enslaved by the characters we create. We depend on them to speak for us. We are ventriloquists of a sort.
I don't create characters.
All the worse for you.
Why?
Because you depend on writers. And writers, Matilda, as figments of their own imaginations, are an inherently undependable lot.
You've really knocked yourself out, proving that point over the past few weeks.
I'm sure your little movie is getting along just fine without me.
You really have no idea what's going on, do you?
The less I know, the happier I am.
Our little movie, as you put it, has come to a complete halt without you.
You needn't lie to make me feel included. Although, I am touched.
Jesus, you really are an ass, you know that?
I extracted my cell phone and dialed Blair's number. He answered in irritation.
Tilly John, where the hell are you?
Guess who I found.
Ah, beauty. Where is he?
We're outside the hotel.
Put him on.
I handed the phone over to Angus, who took it with a sigh and a roll of his tired, bloodshot eyes. I watched his face intently, listening to one side of the conversation and trying to deduce the rest.
Exploring Greater Los Angeles,
he said, mashing his cigarette into the side of the building and dropping the stub into his pocket.
I think your people call it a walkabout. Yes, why is a very good question, Blair. I suppose because what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. If I can survive this city, then I can do anything.
A torrent of humanity bustled past us down the sidewalk, a tour group and marauding shoppers, causing me to step off the curb. They passed between us in twos and threes, and I watched Angus's face, as though through the slats of a moving fence, profiled against the sunlit marble, holding my phone to his ear. I was surprised at how happy and relieved I was to see him. He was a mess to behold. All but the corner of a flap of his denim shirt had escaped the waistband of his khakis, which were generally streaked with grime. One sleeve was rolled up past the wrist, while the other hung open, limply, almost to the knuckles. Both shoes were open and untied. The dark tongues flopped off to the side, as though exhausted from walking, and salivating laces in flat lines along the pavement. His beard had grown shaggy and ill-kempt, and his hair was an unruly shrub of straw. And yet, it was the familiarity that struck me most. It was as though I had known him all my life, and there was something true in that part of him that could not be scuffed and tousled and soiled. Something in him, inexplicably, seemed to define me. A feeling that was as compelling as it was terrifying. Like the very idea of gravity from the ledge of a building. The gentle pull on the viscera. The erogenous buzzing. The parade finally passed, and I stepped back onto the sidewalk, this time leaning my back against the building next to him. Angus was tracing a crack in the pavement with the toe of his shoe.
Just a chance meeting, I think. Yes, so she said. No, she hasn't told me a thing except how much she wants to be an actor. I see. Well, I can't say I'm sorry to hear that. Of course you'll get sued. This is America. That's what we do here. Well, aside from watch TV, shoot guns, and sexually objectify children. But now that steroids have ruined baseball, lawsuits are really our national pastime. Sorry. What can I do for you, Blair?
I looked up at his face to find him looking at me, his features arranged in a reproachful scowl, as though the suggestion had been mine, and I had been clandestinely orchestrating events. I shrugged stupidly.
I understand it would give me more control. I get that. But you see, Blair, it ups the ante, doesn't it? Well, because then it becomes my work, and suddenly we are dealing with my standards. No, the story is my work. The movie has always been your work. What you are now proposing changes that. No, I'm not saying no. I mean, you're gonna make this thing no matter what, right? I suppose I would be an idiot to turn you down. I would have to think about it, and I will not do it without a lot more control over the project. Oh, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Well, then I guess we both have a lot to think about.
With two extended fingers, he handed me my phone, still open and counting the call minutes on its little screen, as though it was a strip of rotting meat he did not understand.
I'm going up to take a bath,
he said, sending a furtive glance skyward, like the gods might have something to say on the matter.
Well?
Well, what?
About Blair's offer. Hello?
I think Blair has a couple of sleepless nights ahead of him. Goodbye, Matilda.
My brain, having no grasp on what had just happened, stalled in confusion. So it was another part of me that responded. When will I see you again? His back was already to me at that point, and he had begun, hands in his pockets, casually threading his way through a colorful throng toward the entrance of the hotel. He did not stop, but slowed. And although it was faint, I did hear his response.
That is entirely up to your boyfriend.
And then he was gone. Despite my unrelenting pressure, Blair refused to enlighten me as to the substance of his conversation with Angus for 5 days. I was expressly forbidden to contact Angus myself.
I need to think, and I can't discuss it right now,
became Blair's favorite mantras, second only to his usual litany of flatteries regarding my body and his increasingly desperate entreaties for sex, which he had taken to calling making love, and which he routinely mistook for seduction. I obliged his needs, but no longer happily, and mostly out of a selfish desire to stay enough in his good graces to learn more about Angus. Emotionally speaking, the only thing more difficult than servicing Blair's increasingly amorous appetite was finding the strength to avoid the thought of Angus's contempt. I found the very idea of his disapproval irresistibly compelling. I fondled it in the dark pocket of my thoughts, like a river stone or sea glass, or a knot of petrified wood that one cannot help but obsessively rub and caress in the way of ancient forces of nature. It was that contempt at the heart of my longing, that old familiar force that had weathered my soul and given me shape. It connected me to Angus, and I nourished the idea as though it were some rare, delicate, and highly poisonous flower. Of course, at the time, I did not recognize this force of motivation as the same that had once compelled my attraction to Blair and to so many others. In fact, I was hardly conscious of it at all. But I suppose it is the irony of attraction and of all irresistible forces that they are the most powerful at depths beneath our comprehension. What had become obvious enough was that Blair had fallen in love, and, I could tell, entertained delusions of an actual relationship founded on alien principles like mutual affection and respect. My strong and inexplicable aversion to that sort of attention, combined with my strong and inexplicable need to romanticize Angus's disdain, led me into the depths of sexual degradation the likes of which I had never experienced before, nor ever since. Entirely at my insistence, my time with Blair spiraled into a series of grotesque circus acts, implausible contortions, which Blair increasingly loathed and I increasingly needed, as both a bulwark against romantic assimilation and as a beacon by which I could locate Angus Mann's justifiably uncharitable judgments about my character. The same carnal perversity that arrested any romantic relationship with Blair brought Angus into sharp relief and, in that way, brought me strange comfort. It was on the sixth day following my sidewalk discussion with Angus, after a particularly vigorous session in the back of a moving limo, that Blair told me that he had spoken again with Angus.
"A decision's made," he said, pulling on his pants.
"What decision?" I asked. "Whose decision?"
"His. Mine."
He pulled his shirt over his head. It was inside out.
"We're requesting the Lion Tree."
I stared at him, mostly naked, in utter disbelief, as the limo crested a hill into the blue sky above Santa Monica. He knew the next question and spared me the trouble.
"Starting with Ivanova,"